Well done, Sally.
Good afternoon, and welcome everyone to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am the Reverend Sally Bingham. I'm an Episcopal priest, and I'm affiliated with the big Gothic cathedral up on the top of Nob Hill, just above here. I work primarily on a campaign called Interfaith Power and Light, and it's a religious response to global warming. But I also have had the great pleasure of officiating at our author, Stephen Nightingale's wedding to his wife, Lucy, who's here in the front row. So I have known them. Celia said he called me the old friend, which is okay, but we have been long time friends. I'd like to also welcome our listening audience, our internet audience, and invite everybody to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now I would like to introduce our distinguished speaker of today, Stephen Nightingale. Stephen writes novels, sonnets, essays, and is the author of Granada, A Pomegranate in the Hand of God, which is the title of our program today. His interests include medieval arts of Spain and Italy, venture capital, and cooking for his treasured wife and daughter. Stephen divides his time between Palo Alto, Nevada, where he was born, and Granada, where he and his family moved in 2001. I'd like to welcome you to the podium, Stephen Nightingale. Here I go.
I couldn't help but love the moment when the Commonwealth Club called and say, "We found a new moderator, the Reverend Sally Bingham. Have you heard of her?" And listen, Sally, I think we should go on the road together and we can introduce each other. We could be a team. Listen, thank you all for coming. Welcome, Diego Muñoz Loveless, the Consul General here in San Francisco in the Spanish Consulate. I want to share with you something of the history of this book. When we moved to Granada in 2001, 2002, with my wife Lucy and our then 18-month-old daughter, Gabriela, we had little idea how deeply we would fall in love with our medieval neighborhood, the Albaicín. It's a 1,000-year-old neighborhood. We made friends there that we cherish to this day. And we went there. I had the idea of writing a trilogy of novels on Spanish history because it's such a fascinating history. And as I read my way into Spanish history, I thought, who needs fiction? Fiction is unnecessary to this enterprise because the story of Spanish history itself is so surprising, so serendipitous, so consequential. And so I thought I could just tell it as it happened. And so that's what I ended up doing. And I had to, we had to as a family, and I had to as a writer learn my way into the history of Spain because in high school and in college, you, of course, learned about the history of Europe. And I had learned, you know, the history of Europe, of Spain, as it's taught in this country, is organized principally around the military conquest of Granada in 1492 by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabel, and the subsequent voyages of Columbus, and then the beginnings of the Spanish Empire. But the history of Spain, which is truly fabulous, is not that history. That's one of the fundamental things that I learned. And I was thinking, riding up on the train, it speaks to the very name of this club, Commonwealth, because what happened in Spain in the Middle Ages is bound up with the Commonwealth of human culture. It's bound up with the Commonwealth of the best of what we do together, our inventions, our technology, our literature, the creation of beauty, when any of us try to give the best of ourselves for the benefit of those we love and for the benefit of strangers. And it is that commonwealth of human experience, that commonwealth of culture, that was so profoundly enriched by the civilization of the Iberian Peninsula in the Middle Ages. And I want to give you just the briefest sketch of the spectrum of human accomplishment during the period which is known to historians as Al-Andalus. And let me define exactly what Al-Andalus is. It is the period on the Iberian Peninsula from 711 to 1492. And during that period, that region was governed by Muslim emirs and caliphs during some centuries, and during other centuries by Christian kings. In each case, both in the case of Muslim governance and in the case of Christian governance, with the absolute key and crucial participation of members from the Jewish community of Al-Andalus. What did they accomplish during that period? Their accomplishments were of the highest order. And I'm going to name some of the fields of human initiative in which they had such accomplishments. Science, in technology, in astronomy, mathematics, agriculture, the most advanced agriculture by far in the Middle Ages, music, medicine, philosophy, storytelling, poetry, and the arts of love, specifically the arts of sexual love. Now, does this sound like an advanced culture to you? Can we all agree on that? I can only touch on a very few of those areas, but I want to give you a taste of how extraordinary this culture was. First of all, in mathematics. Now, we live in a time politically in which nobody can seem to agree on anything. But I think I know one thing all of us in this room can agree on. Can we agree that the Hindu-Arabic number system has been a good and useful thing? Right. Is everybody with me on that one? The question is, how did this fundamental human art of calculation, this number system, come into widespread use in Europe? It came into widespread use because of Al-Andalus, because of the culture of Spain in the Middle Ages. It is, of course, the original books on this written in the Middle East have titles like The Hindu Art of Reckoning. It originated in India. It was worked on by the great mathematicians of the Middle East, including the Muslim inventor of algebra. In the 9th and 10th centuries, those texts were distributed throughout Al-Andalus in that culture. They were worked with, and they were worked with to the extent, and the refinement was to the extent, that the numbers 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and 0 took on the form we use today in Al-Andalus. Every time we write those numbers, there is a debt that we incur to these great scientists and the great mathematicians of Al-Andalus. Now, when you read about the history of Europe, you'll often come across a statement that says, oh, well, the Hindu-Arabic number system was introduced to Europe in the work of Leonardo of Pisa, whom we know as Fibonacci, in the Renaissance. Well, it turns out he copied his work from Jewish and Muslim mathematicians of Al-Andalus. Those works circulated throughout Europe. So that number system came to Europe through Spain. So that's mathematics. Philosophy. Many of you will have heard of the philosopher Averroes. Averroes wrote books on logic. He wrote books on the law, including a compendium of Islamic law. He wrote books on medicine. He was a distinguished doctor. But he is known as a translator and a commentator on the works of Aristotle and of Plato. Those works revolutionized education and theology in Europe. They are essential to the history, the intellectual history of Europe, the work of Averroes. And, I mean, to the extent that even though Averroes was a Muslim, even Dante could not bear to put him in the Inferno in the Divine Comedy. He put him in this special room called Limbo. And Limbo was for people who Dante just could not figure out to do with. But look at the people Averroes had for company in Limbo. He had Plato, he had Socrates, he had Homer. It was good company. I know a Dante scholar, and she said, you know, listen, Limbo is the place to be. Averroes did another extraordinary thing. He, and this is bound up with the history of religion and of science. He said this. He said, the truth that we come to because of our spiritual explorations is the same as the truth we come to by the use of our reason. Now, this is such a revolutionary thought. Averroes said, basically, it was in some fundamental way one of the most effective and most original attacks on religious fundamentalism the world has ever seen. He stated in the most straightforward and clear way that the use of reason is a capacity given to humankind by heaven. It has a divine origin, and it is our duty as humans to explore the world, to observe, to calculate, to analyze, and that the truth, in the long run, the truth that we come to by virtue of that, the work of reason, will come together with the truth we come to in our spiritual quest. This is the declaration of independence for the human mind. It's an extraordinary moment in history. Medicine. Let me touch on the medicine of Al-Andalus. Some of you, perhaps, have had surgery, or someone in your family has had surgery. The question is, if you trace back the history of medicine, where does it go back to? Well, one of the primary places it goes back to is 10th century Cordoba. There was a Muslim physician there, one of the most extraordinary men in the Middle Ages. He's known in the West by his Latin name of Abul Qasis. His Arab name was al-Zawari. And he wrote a 30-volume compendium of the medical arts. The last few volumes were volumes on surgery. Now, this is 10th century Cordoba. He was repairing broken bones and setting limbs in a cast. He was doing surgery on the spinal cord. He was cutting out infected tissue and binding up wounds with sutures of silk. He was doing eye surgery. That's a very small sampling of his surgical techniques. In order to do all this, he had to invent a lot of surgical tools. The work of Abul Qasis as a surgeon, he's known as the father of surgery. His work was translated into Latin 5 times. It revolutionized the work of medicine and the practice of surgery in Europe. But it's the most extraordinary accomplishment. And let me touch on one other domain of initiative here, and that is that of spirituality. One of the fascinating things about this period, and the key term to understand with regard to Al-Andalus, is the term of the beautiful Spanish word convivencia. We don't have that word in English. And it literally means living together. The convivencia referred to, during this whole period of Al-Andalus, the communities of Jews and of Muslims and of Christians living together, making a go of it together. It wasn't without conflict. It wasn't without violence. It wasn't without difficulty. But they produced one of the most extraordinary cultures in the history of Europe, one of the most extraordinary in the history of the Mediterranean. So you have to ask, what happened? What kind of spiritual developments occurred in Al-Andalus as a result of this extraordinary confluence of religions? Well, one thing that happened, and it's fascinating, is the further and deeper development of mysticism in all three faiths. In Christianity, you had the mysticism of Santa Teresa and Saint John of God. In the Jewish community, you had the development and dissemination of the Kabbalah. And in the Muslim community, you had the flowering of the work of the Sufis, who are an extraordinarily accomplished group. And I want to give you just a bit of the flavor of this mysticism by telling you three brief stories, three brief Sufi stories. These are drawn from the work of the Sufi scholar Idris Shah. There's a genre of stories that feature a character named Mullah Nasruddin. Some of you may be familiar with him. And Mullah Nasruddin is sort of somewhere between a saint and a court jester. So this genre of stories is teaching by means of very pointed and sometimes very funny stories. And they're very short. I'll tell you just a couple of them. Because it will give you the flavor of this teaching of the mysticism of Al-Andalus. The Nasruddin was speaking with a king, and the king came to him and said, "Mullah, you know, other conquerors and kings like me, they have titles with God in them, the God exalted, the God admired, the God illuminated, the God favored. I want a title like that. What do you think it should be?" And Mullah said, "Well, let me see. How about God forbid?" In another of these stories, this is this is out of the court. Someone came up to Nasruddin and said, Nasruddin, I have terrible news for you. Your donkey has disappeared." And Nasruddin said immediately, "Thank God I wasn't on it at the time. Otherwise, I would have disappeared too." And a third story, back to the court. This is in the court of the conqueror, the fearsome conqueror, Tamerlane. Nasruddin is among the courtiers in this court, and he says, but he had fallen in favor. So Tamerlane is distributing wonderful gifts to all the courtiers, and so everyone is there in the court opening their gifts, and there are these fabulous robes, you know, sewn with precious jewels, with threads of gold and silver, and Nasruddin opens his, and it's a donkey blanket. And he looks up and he says, "I want you all to see how favored I am of Tamerlane. He has given me the clothes off his own back." Now, what is the thread that ties these three stories together? Part of the thread is to permit us to reflect on the fact that in the minds of many of us, when something happens in the world, we relate it immediately to ourselves. And if there is an emblematic and iconic sentence of mysticism, is that to come into an experience of the divine as we live on this earth, the one essential is to become dead to self and alive to love. These Nasruddin stories, many of these Nasruddin stories, are configured around that idea. And that's merely three of them. And there are hundreds of Nasruddin stories. I recommend them to you. So let me close my remarks and move to your questions, which I'm eager to hear, by telling you of our departure from Spain. It was a reluctant departure. We loved the Albaicin so much. We have friends there whose goodwill and affection and generosity are so memorable to us, and those friendships are so dear to us to this day. But to return to the idea of Commonwealth, we left Spain with the most vivid with a much more informed sense of how the communities of the Iberian Peninsula have contributed to the Commonwealth of human culture in a way that is so extraordinary and memorable and valuable. And so we left with a sense of joy at those accomplishments and with a sense of thankfulness that we had a chance to live in a culture that had given away so many gifts. So thank you.
Thank you, Stephen Nightingale, for your comments on your extraordinary book, Granada, A Pomegranate in the Hand of God. I am the Reverend Sally Bingham, today's moderator, and we are going now into our question and answer period, and we have quite a lot of very interesting questions.
Good.
And I, because I have the microphone, I'm going to take advantage of you a little bit by simply adding that from my personal experience, Stephen Nightingale is a Renaissance man. And I've never said that about anyone before or even really thought it about anyone. But I do recommend this book highly. Now, he was giving you a lot of information that was highly intellectual. The book reads like a romantic novel. So I really I can't recommend it in a more highly way than to say if you really want to learn something about Spain and something about the Albaicin, but also have this sense of an amazing family experience for the 3 or 4 years that you spent there in Granada, and this darling little girl who's now at Castilea School and about 14 years old, I had the pleasure of blessing in Pyramid Lake when she was 6 weeks old, and we blessed her with water and the help of the sun and the moon and the stars, and we all slept on the sand. And this is, I mean, these are things that are unusual in today's life. And this is a wonderful family, a wonderful author, and an extraordinary book. So I will now go back to the intellectual and some of the really, these are really interesting questions. Someone is suggesting Eric Ormsby, writing in the Wall Street Journal, was critical of you presenting the Arab rule as rosier than it was later representative during the phase of Ferdinand and Isabella. And could you comment on that?
You know, that's a fascinating part of the current scholarly debate about Al-Andalus. After the rise of Ferdinand and Isabel, the facts about the scientific and mathematical and literary and technical accomplishments of Al-Andalus were very much suppressed. In fact, you can read a lot of histories and not really learn very much about that important part. I went out of my way in my book to not only describe the very broad range of accomplishments of Al-Andalus, but to make clear that this was no utopia. I mean, to have three religious communities living together in the Middle Ages of Europe was difficult. It was occasionally violent. There were military conflicts. And I treat of those and recognize those very clearly in the book. I think it's important not to gloss over that and to portray the period of Al-Andalus as an adventure of unprecedented harmony in which no one was ever harmed. It's simply not true. At the same time, the weight of historical opinion now, of good scholarship right now, is very clear. The accomplishments of that period and their influence on world history cannot be denied. It cannot be denied any longer.
Thank you. Now, this is a pretty straightforward question. Did ghettos exist during the Andalusia, segregation by religion?
That is an interesting question. And it has a complex answer. See that when in 711, with the incursion of the Muslims from North Africa into the Iberian Peninsula, virtually all of Spain was Christian. And 100 years later, it was still, even though it was under Muslim administration, it was still only 10% Muslim. And there was still a very active and energetic Jewish community there. And so over time, there were intermarriages, there were conversions. Sometimes communities would live together. Sometimes they would live side by side. Some families had a very mixed religious ancestry. Averroes himself probably came from a Christian family, for instance, even though that family had been Muslim for many generations. And so, were there ghettos? There probably were more communities of one faith early in Al-Andalus. And then towards the end of Al-Andalus, especially during the time when Ferdinand and Isabel were in power, previous to 1492, but in those last several decades, they enforced more of a policy of people living in basically religious ghettos. During that period. So I would say mixed during most of the centuries, more intense living in religious communities in early on and later on.
Well, and this question is related to that. I understand that the Jews were the go-between and translators between Christians and Muslims. Could you comment?
You know, they were. It was such a fascinating period. I mean, you read these things and you see these things in Spain, and they bespeak a kind of life which can hardly be imagined now in many parts of the world. For example, there was during some of the period of the Islamic Caliphate, they would have the Islamic government would have a prime minister, and the prime minister would be Jewish. Imagine a Muslim country today with a Jewish prime minister. A bit hard to conceive of. There is a synagogue in Toledo, one of the most beautiful places in Europe, that has quotations from the Quran and emblems of the Christian kings on its walls. I mean, it's like a synagogue of the convivencia. So you have Hebrew, you have Arabic, you have references to the Bible. The Sephardic Jewish community in Al-Andalus was powerful and learned and influential. And, there are five-volume works about the Sephardic community in Al-Andalus. So that in and of itself is an extraordinary story, not to mention the poetry they wrote. I mean, if any of you want to pick up an extraordinary book of poetry, there is a book called The Dream of the Poem. And it is the first translation into English of all the great Jewish poets of Al-Andalus. And the thing is a treasure. It's translated by a world-class scholar named Peter Cole, C-O-L-E. You know, these poems, I mean, you read these poems, the Jewish poetry of Al-Andalus, and they are head and shoulders above any other poetry in medieval Europe. It's just extraordinary. So, my heavens, what a community.
Amazing, yeah. I want to remind our listening audience that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Granada, A Pomegranate in the Hand of God, and our speaker is the author, Stephen Nightingale. I love this question. So will you. Can you expand upon the Spanish, I think this is Middle Age, accomplishments during this period in the field of love?
Oh my. Well, I'd be happy to. There is a book that has been the subject of much scholarly interest. And it is known as the Kama Sutra Español. Now, a bit of history here. Many of you will be familiar with the teachings of medieval Christian theology with regard to women, and especially with regard to the arts of love. And there's two things to emphasize about that. First of all, a lot of these teachings went back to the outlook of Aristotle. And the outlook of Aristotle was basically that a woman is a defective man. And from that, of course, that idea combined with Genesis, in which Eve is blamed for everything, resulted in a strain of misogyny and contempt for women in Christian theology that is remarkable to read and tragic to read. But this of course affected the theological view of female sexuality, and the strictures are incredible in these texts. I mean, for example, in the embraces of the one you love, the key thing is never to feel any pleasure. And not only that, but it is forbidden. Those very embraces, the embraces of a husband and wife in love, are forbidden on Sundays and on any day you go to church and on saints' days. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen the Catholic calendar of saints' days, but, you know, that really doesn't kind of leave a lot of days in the year. And, of course, Catholicism was Christianity then. And so so in that context, here is this text. It was written by a Muslim man who was expelled from Valencia in 1611 with the final years of ethnic cleansing of the Muslim population in Spain. And he wrote this treatise, which is partly mystical and partly carnal. And he says things that all scholars will admit had never been heard. Among them are that it is that in marriage, in the embraces of love, a woman has an equal right to pleasure as a man does. And in addition, that it is, in fact, the marital duty and the spiritual duty of a husband to explore the whole wide range of those pleasures. And he goes into some remarkable detail on that front. I recommend the book to all of you. And so this, I mean, it really is an extraordinary text because he's writing a kind of manual. And there are very funny moments in which he says, you know, what about a woman whose husband, you know, simply has no time for his marriage because he does nothing but pray. And so, of course, he has to go straight to the imam, and the imam has to remind him that there are more important things.
More important.
There are more important, and they're more important, and they're equally important, because he goes on to say that the pleasures of marriage are not merely physical. They're also transcendental, that there is a spiritual content in the love and the devotion we give one another physically that is transformative and partakes of the sacred. It's a beautiful set of ideas, and they had never been heard in Europe. And so there's a whole section of the book on that, if you're interested.
My goodness. All right. Well, let's go back to the practical a little bit. There are two people out there who have somewhat of the same interest, so I'm going to do these two questions together. Okay. Somebody writes regarding mathematics, I did not know that algebra was that old. What was the percentage of the population that were educated? But on the same lines, just a note that maybe to inform the audience that algebra is actually an Arab word, slang with Alhambra and then something I can't read. But two people out there are very interested in the mathematical and algebra part.
Yeah, it's and it is a fascinating subject. The algebra is, in fact, an art invented, the part of mathematics invented by Muslims in the Middle East in around the 9th century. And Al-Khwarizmi, who is the man responsible, is the one who wrote the book called The Hindu Art of Reckoning that was translated in Spain and spread the use of Hindu-Arabic numeration and calculation there. As to the question of what part of the population was engaged in these calculations and what of them were educated, boy, you know, historians really they've been scratching their heads down to, you know, till they have no hair left on that subject, because it's very hard to know. What we do know is that Al-Andalus had the most developed libraries in Europe. Cordoba, during its height, had a library of four under the Muslim caliphs, had a library of 400,000 volumes. 400,000 volumes. The largest library in Europe of the time outside of Al-Andalus had a few thousand volumes, 2,000 or 3,000. Was in a monastery. So what we can say to that question, there was a culture of learning, there were resources for learning, there were places of gathering where learning occurred. What percentage of the population was able to take full advantage of that? Boy, you know, the jury's out. The historical jury is out on that one.
How about regarding medicine? Someone wants to know if once the surgery or the surgical instruments were developed, did they go through a period of decline? That would be, I guess, once the instruments have been developed, then somehow did medicine decline?
Because so many of the people we know about in Al-Andalus were polymaths, that is, whether Christian or Muslim or Jewish, many people practiced, you know, really in many different disciplines. So they would do law and they would do medicine and they would do a number of other things. So far as I've been able to ascertain from, you know, reading the hundreds of books that you have to read to write a book like this, the practice of medicine really did continue on very vigorously. And the evidence of that is in some of the medical practices that you find. For example, the practice of giving anesthetics. Now, you know, you see these surgical instruments, and as I say in the book, you know, you open the page of these books of surgical instruments, and you just want to run for the hills. I mean, you know, don't come near me with those. So the question is, what did they do about that? It turns out there was a tradition of the use of anesthetics that came also from Muslim physicians in the Middle East. And they used mandragora. They used opium. They used an herb called henbane. And they used cannabis. And they used these in various combinations and in various doses. And what's interesting is, and this is another example of the scientific development of especially Muslim and Jewish physicians in Al-Andalus, what's interesting is that they were very interested in calculating doses, the right dosage that fit the malady of their patient. So those are two things: the calculation of dosages and the use of anesthetics. There's a third thing too, which makes me think that medicine continued with vigor during this period, and that is that there was an extensive development of herbal medicine because botanical study was so richly and deeply developed in Al-Andalus. There are compendiums of recommendations for treatments, herbal treatments. And they literally studied hundreds of different herbs and their combinations in relation to particular maladies that that a patient may have. So really, there really is a lot of received and used medical knowledge, a lot of sunk costs there.
I have another two questions that are related to one another. What happened to Spain after the Jews and the Muslims were forced to convert, die, or leave? And on the same subject, is it true that descendants of the Jews who were kicked out of Spain in 1492 have been offered Spanish citizenship now?
Yeah, fascinating question. Now, this, of course, is let me take the first question first.
Okay.
This is, of course, directly relevant to our current political situation here in the United States because you know, there is a in our own country, there is a reaction, against the notion of diversity in all its forms, religious diversity, ethnic diversity. And the question, so that leads naturally to the question, what happens to a country if you impose religious and ethnic conformity upon it? And what's fascinating about that question is that it's been tried. Ferdinand and Isabella did that. They did that very thing. They had Al-Andalus was the most advanced culture in Europe, one of the most advanced cultures in the Mediterranean. And in 1492, Ferdinand and Isabel expelled the Jewish community, those who were unwilling to convert. And they began the ethnic cleansing of the Muslim community. And in addition, they introduced the Spanish Inquisition, the programmatic violence of which is extraordinary to read about and important to learn about. What happened to Spain? What happened to the prosperity and advancement of Spain as a result of those expulsions and that ethnic cleansing? You know, I tell the story in the book, but if I had to put it in one sentence, is that it was a kind of national suicide. I mean, this was the most prosperous, advanced culture in Europe. In the next 130 years after 1492, how many times did Spain, as a country, declare bankruptcy? Seven times. They went bankrupt as a country seven times. And this is with a current of silver and gold coming in from the New World. The principal use of those precious metals, they ended up having two uses. First of all, it funded the military operations of the Spanish army throughout Europe. And then to those of you who are involved in business in any way, it did another fascinating thing. It funded the commercial development of the rest of Europe. It's the most extraordinary story. In the book, I say that, you know, as a result of this ratcheting down of Spain, based upon the religious fundamentalism of Ferdinand and Isabella, Spain somehow missed out on the winning trifecta of European history. It missed out on the Industrial Revolution, and on the Enlightenment, and on a good deal of the Renaissance as well. So I think we know what happens when you destroy that rich ferment and cross-pollination of ideas that you have in any country where you have significant diversity and you have that confluence of values and interests and kinds of genius. So it's one of the very few clear historical examples I know of what happens to a country when they wipe out their diversity.
Well, you're leading right into a couple more questions that are close along those lines. One is, can you make a connection between the history of medieval Spain and the current situation in the U.S.? And the second question tied to that actually talks about the Trump phenomenon.
Oh, the Trump phenomenon, my heavens. I do think that the connections are self-evident. I mean, we have in our own country major political figures in the current Republican or perhaps so-called Republican nominee is an example of that. We have political powers in this country who would like to impose upon our country, which has had for all these centuries one of the most successful convivencias on earth. I mean, the United States is built upon this extraordinary mix of cultures from around the world. And to suggest that we should begin using force and using the force of national law to turn away from that is something that it is hard to believe anyone in their right mind would suggest. but here, you know, here we are, but it will be an exceptionally important referendum on the understanding of the American people about the beauty and the energy and the accomplishment that has come about as a result of the diversity of this country.
I'm the Reverend Sally Bingham, and I want to remind our listening audience that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Granada, A Pomegranate in the Hand of God, and we are having a conversation with the author, Stephen Nightingale. Now, back to the religion. Do you think that the harmony that was happening in the Albaicin, in Spain, before Ferdinand and Isabella, might ever happen again, where Jews, Muslims, and Christians could all come together?
You know, I think for me the best answer to that is that it's already happened. It has happened in the United States, not without conflict, not without occasional violence, not without difficulty. But this is one of the preeminent countries of what I think of as convivencia. I mean, you look at the diversity in this country's history and you know, everyone will admit, every historian will admit that it wasn't always easy. But I think it's happened here. I think it has happened in some parts of Europe that have been more open to that. This convivencia between religious communities was for many centuries, especially in the Middle Ages, a natural part of Muslim life. I mean, there were communities of Christians and Jews and Muslims living together in the Middle East for centuries, very productive communities. And it's important. I mean, sometimes I've said this, of course, and been sort of taken to task about how that's impossible and it never could have happened. But it's a result, I think, those attitudes are a result of a way people today are often profoundly misinformed about Muslim history and about just the very nature of Islam. For example, if you go around sometime as a reverend and ask people this question, is Jesus a central and honored figure in the Quran? And most people will tell you no. In fact, Muhammad did not claim to bring a new faith. Jesus, but Jesus and Moses and Abraham are in the Quran as prophets, as the bearers of revelation, as Muhammad brought a revelation. And so the idea that these religions are somehow irrevocably and violently meant to be apart, it's just untrue. It's simply untrue. There are fundamentalists in every religion. And so I think it's exceptionally important for people to come into a deeper understanding of spiritual traditions other than their own, so that instead of making assumptions and presuming antagonism, they can make connections and build understanding and affection on the way to all our common work together.
Mm-hmm. And let me add, building on that, that today here in the United States, in my experience of working with Jews, Muslims, Christians, Baha'is, Mormons, Roman Catholics, evangelicals, we work on an interfaith ministry to show that people of faith are responsible for the environment. Mm-hmm. And this program, the unintended consequence is that we have all these different religions sitting around the table together agreeing that we are the stewards of creation. And it's been an extraordinary adventure to be part of that coming together of these religions. So I guess there's nothing stronger than to bring people together is the common enemy. Mm-hmm. And what's happening with climate change, which is the subject we work the most on, people are beginning to realize that we're going to have to do something about this problem, and we can't do it divisively. We need to have Jews, Muslims, and Christians all working together to solve some of that problem.
You know, I think that example is right on the mark, and it's a very, very moving one. I mean, we can, whatever our faith, we can work together for the common good, and we can do it in a powerful and consequential way. And your work on climate change with people of a range of faiths is just a perfect example of that.
Well, we are out of questions, and you and I can just have a little conversation and let other people listen. I have been to your house. That is rather extraordinary. I stayed there just this last Christmas holiday with my family. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about the washing machine, the clothes washer. But the lesson that we learned while we were there is that the appliances in Spain are a great deal more energy efficient than they are here. And you have what I have to assume is a elderly washing machine,
but very efficient.
It eats your clothes. If you don't put it in properly, and it has this little basket at the top, and if you don't get everything in there properly, and you run the machine, and then you go back to get your clothes out, they're gone. They're just plain not there. Yeah. Now,
See, we supplement our income by selling lost clothes in the bottom of the washing machine.
We had somebody come over who had to turn it upside down, take the bottom out, and retrieve our clothes from underneath it. We have time for one last question. If anybody – is anyone in the audience interested in asking another question? I think the big one that's come really from three different people is whether or not you felt that the Jews, Muslims, and Christians could all live together in harmony again. I have two more questions about that. But there's a question right here.
Yeah. I'd be interested to know, is there a large expat community in the Abbasin?
You know, the Abbasin is really, really principally a Spanish community. But there is a mix of – there are some families from the United States. There's a family from Germany. There was a family from Israel there. So there is some mixture, and it's increasingly rich because some people are renting out their Carmens now far more than ever before than when we went there. So I would say the mix in the Abbasin is becoming further enriched. But I and that's all to the good. I Lucy and I and our daughter came back from the Abbasin, and I was convinced, and I have written, and I remain convinced to this day, that it is one of the best places in the world to live, one of the best places there will ever be to live.
We have one more question out in the audience.
Yes.
I wonder if you could comment on what you saw as the role of women during this time.
Fascinating question. Women in Al-Andalus did extraordinary work. There are, for example, female poets during the period of Al-Andalus, Muslim poets, whose work is known to us today. And there also is on record women, the work of women who were textual scholars of the Quran and who participated in teaching. So it was not a period – we don't have a lot of information, at least that I have seen in the historical record about that, but – there were female poets and scholars and musicians who were very gifted and at work in Al-Andalus over the course of those centuries. And those very women, especially the musicians, came to exercise a very powerful influence on European poetry. The first vernacular poetry written in Europe, the poetry of the troubadours, was deeply influenced by the female musicians, who were singers of Al-Andalus. So their work is still with us.
Well, unfortunately, we could go on all afternoon, but we have time for one more question from the back of the room.
Hi, my name's Aida. I work at Zaytuna College, which is the first Muslim liberal arts college in the United States, which is in Berkeley, California. Uh-huh. And I'm curious to know, how are you extending some of your work out to young people?
You know, I would love to. I teach by invitation in schools at all levels, and I love teaching. So the way I'm extending it is that I go where I'm invited. But thank you for asking. It's something I love to do.
Thank you, Stephen Nightingale. And for our listening audience, people here and on the internet and listening on the radio, we're very grateful to have had you with us this afternoon. I am Sally Bingham, your moderator for today's program, which was called Granada, a Pomegranate in the Hand of God. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussions, is adjourned.
Bravo.
Way to go, Sally. You're up.